And here they come.
Onto the field.
The Australian Laughing Championship. Mr. Walter Carruthers, all the way from Tempe, and he's putting on a fine show today. And in number two position, Mr. Eric Grope.
Keeping the nation regular, this is ABC Brand Fiber Radio, and we'll be back in half an hour without Tony Baldwin, Kevin Daly, Peter Whitford, Jane Harders, Jill McKay, Bill Conn, Lance Curtis, Angela Weber, Adam Bowen, and Peter Smalley. Music by Arthur Greenslade and his Bondi broadcasters, with special guest Terry Legarn with the Kyushu Chorale, and Suede Custard, the happiness boy. Meanwhile, we're slightly out to lunch.
To his mind, I was rugged.
Hey, I'm a little looking forward to the second half. Hear me to tell.
Yeah, there you go, Diver. Oh, I think I must have strained me groin again. Gee, this bloke Tchaikovsky sure takes it out of you.
Yeah, you're right for the second half.
Oh, you know, worries. I've gone out with injuries before.
Yeah, I know just what you mean. I've had hamstring trouble since we first met the Swans, you know.
Yeah, it's the length of the season that does it. Yeah. There I was in the middle of a grind jetty. I heard this ripping sound, see?
Yeah.
Thought, hello. Why, the groin's gone again. I've laddered me tights.
Didn't seem to slow you down, mate. You'd be a dead suit for me in the match, if you asked me.
Thanks, mate. Thanks a lot. Hold on. Here comes the choreographer.
All right, yous blokes, settle down. Now, what's wrong with yous blokes? You're dancing like a mob of Sheilas. There's gaps out wide. You're not supporting your silk feeds. And don't be afraid to go up and take the high ballerina.
Right, yeah.
That reminds me, Tank. You're supposed to have the safest pair of hands in ballet. We didn't pay the Sydney Dance Company $50,000 for you to send a wood nymph into the orchestra pit.
Sorry, Coach.
And this half, I want you to mark Sleeping Beauty a lot closer in the pas de deux. You're letting it dance all over the stage. Right. Remember, the back line's some of the best kickers in ballet. So stay out of range.
Right.
I want you to go out there and dance!
Okay.
Dance!
Fight! We're the blokes in the purple tights. Hit 'em low, hit 'em high. Yeah, get all out of the fight.
And now it's time for our weekly Pets Corner with our regular veterinary consultant, Bruce Losis. Welcome, Bruce.
Hello there, nice to be with you again, and as usual I'm speaking to you from my busy surgery here in the clinic at Brainage Hills, and this week's letter comes from Warwick Thwett of Oozing Flats. Yes, Warwick, I know the flats only too well, and you write, Dear Bruce, my mum and dad are getting a divorce, and they're always arguing and fighting. Sometimes I get caught in the middle, and they don't seem to know I'm there. What kind of pet can I get that will protect me? Gee, that's sad about your parents, Warwick, and I can understand how you might feel about needing protection, but I wonder if we could look at the underlying problem in the marriage for a moment. The truth is, I think, that the reason your mum and dad are breaking up is your dad's mother, your grandmother, Gran. Now, Gran, it isn't a bad old thing, really, but when it comes to your dad, well, she gets a bit silly in the head, doesn't she? Nothing's too good for your dad, who's certainly not someone like your mum. This is why Gran tries to run her over in the Honda Civic, and it's why she puts cyanide in those little cinnamon cakes she brings over for afternoon tea, and writes all those horrible letters with the razor blades stuck inside the envelope. So, now we've established the root of the trouble, Warwick, let's get back to your question. What kind of pet will protect you during violent domestic confrontation? Well, frankly, Warwick, I think what you need as a pet isn't an animal at all. What you need is a .357 Magnum revolver. Because an animal, no matter how ferocious, is no match for a long-bladed butcher's knife or a heavy-duty meat cleaver. I really do think the revolver is the answer here, Warwick, and Smith & Wesson turn out a very good model in that caliber, and just so long as you join your local pistol club, You should have no trouble obtaining one, and most respectable sports stores sell them these days. All right, Warwick, good hunting. And now this is Bruce Lassus saying goodbye till next time, and please bear in mind that a gun makes a very easy pet to care for, because all you have to do is feed it ammunition.
Buenos dias, amigos. You're listening to La Voz de la Junta. And now, lesson 12 in our series, The Spanish Language for Visitors to Central America. Listen and repeat. 1.
No tire. Yo soy un agente de la CIA.
Don't shoot. I am an agent of the CIA. 2.
No me torture. Le diré todo lo que sé.
Please do not torture me. I will tell you everything.
No, senor. Ah!
That's it for this week, amigos. Next time, we'll be learning some in-flight conversation tips for when your plane is unexpectedly rerouted to Havana, Cuba. Meanwhile, adios, amigos.
Channel 14, backed by the giant resources of the Richard Mediocrity Organization, proudly presents episode 27 of Body Hair. The epic story of the controversial English tiddlywink tour of Australia in 1893. The story so far.
In the last test, Australia's 9-year-old winking phenomenon, Ginger Blanche, led his team to victory by deftly flicking tubes and lollies into the mouths of the unsuspecting English players on the field. Still smarting from his defeat, the ruthless toffee-nosed English skipper and fruit gum addict, Jarvis Bedsock, develops the unorthodox style of play, later to be known as body hair. Meanwhile, Ginger Bludge has his own problems.
We've really been dropped in at this time, lads. The Amalgamated Guild of Lolly Packers and Denture Manufacturers are refusing to supply the wine gums.
Oh, what?
Unless they get free advertising round the ground and sponsorship credit.
Oh, really? Oh,
geez, I mean...
Melbourne journalist Schooner O'Hack recalls the events of that exciting summer.
Well, geez, it was a long time ago. I remember being in the bar. Then I was on the floor. It was that new beer they started swilling up. Give me a moment, mate. I think it's coming back to me. No, it isn't, no.
Meanwhile, in London, the monocled and pampered wimps and sissies in charge of England's team plan their ruthless and unsportsmanlike attack on the Aussies.
I say, fag, I've run out of fruit gums. Run up to the tuck shop and get some for me. Chop, chop now, young Harry Bygum. Get a move on or you'll get six of the best.
Hey, Bygum, no, Mr. Bedsock, do I have to? I only brought you a chip butty and bread and dripping half an hour ago.
Do as I say, boy. No, wait a minute. With an accent like that, you could make a fine tiddlywinks champion. Tell me, have you ever been near a coal mine?
Been down a coal mine? You been down a coal Bagum, I was born down the colliery. Me mum were a pick pony, Bagum.
Capital. Make sure you're on the clipper for Vancouver tomorrow.
But sir, Vancouver's in Canada.
Yes, boy, I know. Just checking.
The first encounter between the two sides took place at historic Sydney Tiddlywink Ground. Tens of thousands packed into the stands, leapt to their feet with indignation when Bedsock's vile tactics were revealed. The journalist Schooner O'Hack remembers it well.
Skinner, a new place, mate? Cheers. Well, there, where was I? It was Federation here, wasn't it? Yeah, the Japs had just bombed Darwin. Farlap was in the finals of the Davis Cup, if my memory serves me correct. Anyway, I remember the tour. There's enough to make your hair stand on end. I met that Bedsock bloke. What a winker. You know, there was something about him that was on the nose. It was what we called body hair.
How would Australia answer Bedsock's below-the-belt attack? Where do the pit ponies come in? Will Ginger Bludge get his secret weapon, wine gums, and formulate the way for his country to escape from body hair? you have a desire to travel and meet interesting people? Well, you too can become one of the elite Alaskan canned salmon. Eugene, a bright young salmon from Peterborough, South Australia, joined their ranks only a few months ago and has already featured on national television in Margaret Fulton's Salmon Mornay. While Beatrice of the Indian Ocean, canned in January, has already given half of the Icelandic royal family salmonella poisoning. So, if you're pink of the gills and spend more time in the bath than most of your friends, you too could be a salmon!
Hello, Jean-Luc Vichyssoise with World Cinema. An exciting week at the Tokyo Festival with a handful of stunning Japanese releases, some intriguing suicides, and the introduction of aphrodisiac popcorn. The crowning jewel in the festival was, of course, the re-release of Japanese master director Yamamoto Kawasaki's The Pearl in Man's Eyes, based on Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, and set in a pearl-diving community on an isolated island of 13th century Japan. Conflict grows as the supply of twin sets from the embattled mainland dries up and the villagers realize they have no use for pearls. Tohatsu Suzuki is excellent as a young pearl diver who has secretly always found Japanese food too bland and hatches a plan to overthrow the warlord and open a chain of combined pizza parlor smash repair shops with the help of cheap labor from Korea. In a film that is otherwise iron grey in its grimness, welcome light relief is provided when a local warlord, played by Sayonara Honda, attempts to win Gokiboi's betrothed, Yoko Walkman, in this glittering production number, The Exquisite Dance of the Seven Sumo Wrestlers.
The way they entertain would hurry a hurricane. Back in Nagasaki where the fella chewed the baggy and the wimmy wiggy wacky were. A Fujiyama, you get a mama, and then your troubles increase. It's a pagoda, she orders soda, shakes milkshakes 10 cents apiece. They kissy and hug in ice. By jingo, it's worth the price. Back in Nagasaki where the fella chewed the baggy and the wimmy wiggy wacky were. Look after him, Bob.
Holidays?
Yes, sir. Madam, please sit down.
Thank you.
We were looking for something a bit different, you know. We were having a look through one of your brochures.
Oh, yeah.
Excitement, adventure, exotic places.
I see.
Sounded just the thing.
Well, what holiday in particular attracted your interest, sir?
Well, this one here. A fully escorted assault on the unconquered northeast face of Mount Everest.
Ah, yes, a very popular one, that. You actually start from the Tibetan border, and we provide you with tents, climbing equipment, Sherpa bearers, and this very attractive passport holder.
Oh, that's very nice. Lovely, isn't it, George?
The thing is it dangerous?
Dangerous? Oh, dear me. Dangerous, extremely. It's pretty likely one of you won't come back.
Oh, dear, that's no good then. It's our daughter's wedding in June, and we both want to be here for that. She's done very well. A chartered accountant. His name's Hilton.
Oh, yes, well done. Look, we do have this new holiday here. It's not even in the brochure yet. An expedition down the Shat Al Arab Waterway in a rubber raft.
Mm-hmm.
The high points of this tour are, of course, the excellent views of the fighting between Iran and Iraq in the war zone.
Mm-hmm.
You actually leave from Karachi in Pakistan, sail across the extremely treacherous Persian Gulf to the Straits of Hormuz, and from there you're on your own.
On our own?
Yes, our guide will make off in the night with most of your equipment, your traveller's checks and any jewellery, watches, etc. that you have with you. However, he definitely won't be cutting your throats. There's a clause in this contract that denies him any throat-cutting facilities. We don't want any of our customers coming back saying they've had their throats cut before they've had a chance to enjoy themselves.
No.
Like some of those other companies.
Well, it sounds very nice.
How long is the holiday for?
Well, you should allow roughly 2 months, depending on whether you're captured by the revolutionary forces of the Ayatollah and tortured, and perhaps an extra 10 days if your charming wife here is kidnapped and molested by the marauding soldiers.
Oh, it all sounds very nice.
Yes, it does. I don't think I could get that long off work, though.
One of our shorter holidays is this one. The Club Jihad in Afghanistan. The holiday is for just 2 weeks. I have the itinerary here. It's a quick raid on the Russian military installations of your choice, somewhere around Kabul with a rebel raiding party. You'll be billeted in a 5-star cave in the mountains on the night before the raid. And while you're in the country, I'm told you can get some very nice souvenirs. Belichnikov rifles, bloodstained turbans, 12-inch scars, that sort of thing. The cost of the tour includes 2 grenades, an automatic rifle, and travel to and from the airport.
Yeah, I always wanted to go to Asia.
Well, you know, it may be your last chance before the rebels are totally wiped out. But I do think it's fair to warn you that fatalities run at about 2 in 3, so if you really must attend your daughter's wedding in June,
I see what you mean. Mm. Perhaps we should try something quieter then, dear, eh?
Well, this holiday here might suit you. South Pacific Island, totally deserted. Long, unspoiled beaches. And if you like fishing, the marine life is practically floating on top of the lagoon waiting to be picked up.
Oh, I love that.
And it's great for sunbaking, too. Some days you can get a really good all-over 10 in about 30 seconds.
Oh, really? And what's the name of this place?
Murarato.
How do you spell that?
Across the seas, around the globe, out of the outback, and into your local theatre. It's the Cooey Newsreel. I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and the sky. And that's just where HMAS Melbourne, our last and greatest aircraft carrier, is headed. From what many people thought was her final berth, the grand old ship is guided down Sydney Harbour by the tug Nifty Neville on the first leg of her journey to Europe. There she'll become the flagship of the mighty Swiss Navy, or the Alp Maritime, as it's known in the home of the cuckoo clock. Farewell, Bonnie Lass, off to defend the snowy peaks and the numbered bank accounts of the gnomes of Zurich. The exotic Philippines. And the annual stir-fried boat festival on the shores of picturesque Lake Ferdinand. Thousands of happy peasants in the colourful national costume of helmet, black jacket and matte-finished self-loading rifle gather round bonfires of obsolete literature and ballot boxes. The governor of Ferdinand province, General Jesus Macabre Toledo, climbs from his jeepney to give the traditional blessing to the festival with a sweep of his military sword, a gift from the Australian government. But whoops, the excited general accidentally obscures the cooey camera with his foot. Never mind. We've seen enough to know that all's well that ends well in the steamy Philippines. Madagascar, where Australian scientist Sir Gordon Bowell is conducting research into the possibility of crossing the Madagascar lemur with the Australian sheep. Sir Gordon hopes to produce an animal that can be shorn upright, thus preventing severe back strain in shearers and saving valuable space in transport vehicles. The hybrid animal, to be called the leap, will be able to live either on the ground or in the trees, as does Sir Gordon himself when he's in the field. It makes everything easier, grins the scientist as he hangs upside down for our cameras. A brilliant Australian on the verge of a breakthrough in the jungles of Madagascar. France! And champion Australian cyclist Doug Flatulence pedals away on the first section of the world's toughest race, the Tour de France. Section 3, and Doug is lying fourth after a grueling night through the mountains. But what's this? Favorite Sven Bloodlust has left the road and is plunging down an embankment. Belgian Alphonse Crudité follows, and American contender Herman Killjoy crashes too. Doug Flatulence hits the front, the final section, and Doug is way ahead. But alas, both his tires are punctured on the home stretch, and in despair, Doug throws himself under a lorry. A gallant Australian makes a brave but futile gesture in the grueling Tour de France. An impressive blend of sportsmanship and stupidity in the centuries-old Tour de France. The Cooey Newsreel, across the globe, out of the outback, and into your theatre.
I'm watching before we use her. He's a pretty vicious bastard.
I'll be all right now, guard. Mr. Jack, my name is Mr. Darrow. I've been appointed to represent you.
It's about time you got here. I've been here a day and I don't even know what I've been charged with. What happened to habeas corpus, eh?
I've got the full list of charges here, and it's not a pretty story. I quote, the defendant is charged that on three separate occasions he did, by means of an unlicensed beanstalk, force entry into the penthouse apartment of Mr. Howard Huge, well-known giant.
I was shopping for me poor sick mother.
And furthermore, that the defendant did make off with gold and goods to an insured value of $10 million.
I was framed.
And that making his escape, he did engineer the collapse of said beanstalk, causing Mr. Huge to plummet to his death and cause extensive property damage to surrounding houses.
Says who?
A 20-meter man doesn't plummet from the sky in a densely populated area without witnesses, Mr. Jack.
Well, what makes them think it was me?
You were standing there with an axe.
So I admit it. I chopped out a beanstalk. How was I to know there was anybody up there? It was blocking the view from me kitchen window.
And you deny climbing the beanstalk to ransack Mr. Huge's residence?
Yeah.
But what of the stolen goods in your possession?
It's a frame-up! The cops planted them on me when I wasn't looking.
Have you ever tried to slip an angry goose into someone's pocket when they're not looking?
Not to mention
the harp that sings by itself. It could be heard miles away, singing, hey, you, get off my cloud.
Society's to blame. It's the beanstalk's fault.
And from where did you obtain the beanstalk?
I grew it from beans. I met this guy on the road who gave me a couple of beans for me cow.
I assume you're planning to plead insanity, then.
What?
Listen. Jack, I'm your lawyer. I can't help you unless you're totally honest with me. I just want you to tell me the whole story, step by step, exactly the way it happened, and make it believable.
Okay. Now, once upon a time, in a little cottage, there lived a boy named Jack and his mother. They were very poor. And one day...
That's more like it.
On Superstation Channel 14 tonight, Danger Deli returns. The shoplifter's own suspense-filled drama of the chain store. Danger Deli bringing a new dimension to the excitement and thrills of supermarket shopping after dark. Danger Deli, you could be mugged in the aisles, abused by surly shelf stackers. Danger Deli, you could be crushed by avalanches of dog food and crazed trolley thrill seekers. Danger Deli, where topless shoplifters race through the landmines to the car park. Tonight, will the manager's bulletproof dress return from the dry cleaners in time for late night opening? Danger Deli, the savagery of shopping, only on Channel 14. Dare you watch it alone.
Hello again and welcome to all you lovely people. And today we have with us in the studio the man who's formed the first all-fish rugby league football team, Mr. Arthur Encephalitis. And welcome, Arthur.
Hello, Gareth.
Now, what first gave you the idea of forming an all-fish rugby league team?
Well, actually, God spoke to me.
God spoke to you?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
What did he say?
Well, I couldn't catch it all. It was in Hebrew. But I think the gist of it was, Arthur, you're a loony.
I see. And how on earth do you go about recruiting members for a fish football team?
Well, the nucleus of the team was formed by my two-bit goldfish, Roger and Nigel.
And they showed an aptitude for rugby league football, did they?
No, none whatsoever.
Oh.
In fact, they've been rather a disappointment. I've tried them as props, hooker and 5'8". They've actually been a dismal failure, but they do show a lot of heart.
Well, then, who else do you have in the team?
Well, there's two barramundi, four guppies, three brim and a snapper. We did have a halibut, but he got poached by another team.
That's amazing. Now, I believe you've just signed a new star player.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We bought him last week from the Deep Blues. He's actually a hammerhead shark, and he's very effective in the scrums, as he tends to bite the opposing prop forward's leg off.
What are your hopes of taking out the premiership this year?
Rather remote, actually, Prakash. Despite some pretty intensive training, the finer points of rugby league seem to have eluded them. And apart from the shark and the blue whale, they haven't shown much aggression so far.
Yeah, but how many games have you actually won so far this season?
None, actually.
None?
In fact, no. We've yet to get into the opponent's half. Oh. We've lost all our games and we've yet to score a point.
Well, one could be forgiven for thinking, then, that the team's been a total failure.
Oh, well, no, not a total failure, no. There is one thing my fish can do better than most rugby league players.
Well, what on earth is that?
Well, they give more intelligent interviews.
Every nation in creation has its favourite meal. France is famous for its frogs, in America it's brunch. The Lebanese tabbouleh and the Viennese schnitzel. Indians go for tiffin. In Australia, it's lunch. When your new sports car is roaring and all the brakes and gears begin to crunch, don't try to do the ton when the clock strikes one. Go slightly out to lunch. And the boxer may be boxing and just about to land on a hot punch, but the towel's thrown in when he's about to win. He's slightly out for lunch. It's a very good Aussie custom, and your life is never dull, with a calamari entree, exquisite chocolate mornay, and a steak that's overdone. Said Sherlock Holmes to Watson, elementary or maybe it's a hunch, the thief had just begun when the clock struck one. He's slightly out for lunch.
Pal.
Yes, sir?
You got my order wrong. I wanted a plate of egg and beans with chips. Bread and butter. What do I get? Filthy pâté de canard au foie gras with champignons de pain farci à la Provençale.
Sorry, sir.
Get rid of it, matey. And if you don't want to be a cripple for the rest of your life, pal, take a look at that magnum for Uncle Chateau Lafitte 59 and give us a mug of tea.
Yes, sir.
Oh, they made it playing football, and down into a scrum they all bunched. They might have won, but the clock struck one, now they're slightly out to lunch. The golfer may be golfing, and about to get a hole in one for once, when his caddy on the run shot is almost won, we're slightly out to lunch. It's a very good Aussie custom, and a stimulant for the brain. If it's wet or if it's sunny, spending lots of plastic money on magnums of champagne. So the lunch is laid before you, and all the menus gobbled down and munched. You stagger through the door back to work by four, slightly out to lunch.
You've been slightly out to lunch with me, Arthur Greenslade, with a script by Tony Baldwin, Kevin Daly, Steve Johnson, Ken Matthews, Peter Smalley, James Overton, Captain Lamington, Colin Bowles, Lance Curtis, Angela Webber, Adam Bowen and John Collins. Production assistant was Linda Hughes. Script editor, Julianne Ford. Sound effects by John Farkas. Technical production by Warwick Maver. Produced by Kevin Daly and Tony Baldwin.
I was listening to Slightly Out to Lunch the other day.
Me?
Yeah.
Me?
I heard three actual jokes on the program.
Three?
Three.
He's a better man than I am.
I love it. Always listen.
Why?
In case they mention my name.
Why would they mention your name, pal?
I don't know, but you never know.
And that was Slightly Out to Lunch.